This is the Feminem Podcast, the official podcast of Feminem, discussing all things femme, a little bit of EM, and everything in between. I am Dara Cass, editor-in-chief of Feminem.
And I'm Jenny Beck-Esme, the other editor-in-chief of Feminem, and today we have a guest.
I'm Risa E. Lewis, two S's. I'm the hugest advocate of the Feminem Speakers Bureau, and I'm the Fixed Content Committee Chair.
That's right. You are the Fixed Content Committee Chair. And the reason you're helping us introduce these Fixed Talks, Risa, is that you and I have been amongst the team that have been reviewing the submissions for next year's Feminem Conference. And Dr. Lewis, how do you think that's going?
Well, there are so many adjectives that we could conjure, that we could use to describe the reaction to the applications and submissions. Overwhelmed in a positive way, complimented, moved. The bottom line is we received close to 200 submissions.
No, it's amazing. It is exactly that. It's a little overwhelming. We're going through the content and the submissions right now. We want to thank everyone out there who submitted and gave us really your heart in a file to tell us the story that you wanted to tell at the conference. As you can tell by these talks, we are feeling that there is a space here for everybody to really share their voice. So I guess this is the first chance where Risa and I and Jenny and Esther Chu, who's not here, can say thank you.
Huge yeah, thank you. Much respect for the bravery in the submissions.
Yeah, thank you guys for putting yourselves out there. It's fantastic. Now, as a reminder, in case you don't remember, I know you all do, but just in case you're new to the podcast, Fix 18 will take place October 16th through 18th in New York City. It's going to be fantastic. All the details can be found at the website, feminem.org. Mark your calendar now so you don't miss it.
And now we'll be on to our Fix 17 talk from last year. This is actually a panel that we put together. Esther Chu moderated a panel called Champions of Change, and it was actually two male physicians, Dr. Adam Brown, who is an executive vice president at Envision Physician Services, and Dr. Michael Gisondi, who is now the vice chair of education at Stanford University. And the reason we put both of these physicians with Dr. Chu was to talk about the place and the space for male champions of change, specifically related to gender equity. This is a concept that was actually founded in Australia. It's a really well-known concept in business and industry. And we know that in medicine, if we're going to make change related to gender, it's definitely going to be a in it together, stronger together movement. And so we wanted to bring two voices of champions of change in there with us. So without further ado, here is Dr. Gisondi, Dr. Brown, and Dr. Chu talking about being champions of change.
So for this session, we're here to talk about becoming a champion of change. I know all of you are invested in some type of change because you're here today. And it may be that you're thinking about the change we need to bring to our workplaces to bring greater equity and opportunity for women. Or this week, you may be completely focused in on your individual change. 16 years after graduating from medical school, I'm still kind of wondering where my career is going. I think the exciting thing about Fix 17 is knowing that we can come together, be newly inspired, and take things to the next level, no matter where we are in our careers. My name is Esther Chu. I am an emergency medicine physician and a health policy researcher at Oregon Health and Science University. I'll be participating in and moderating this panel. I'm happy to be here with two colleagues that I admire. Just to introduce them at the beginning so you know who's sitting up here. Dr. Mike Gisondi is to your right, to patients' right. Just to make sure. He's an emergency medicine physician who trained at Stanford University. He went on to be the program director at Northwestern for a number of years, and while he was program director, he made sure that the number of women matched or exceeded the number of men on the rank list year after year. He's now in a new position as vice chair of education back at Stanford. And in that role, he's really taken major strides in increasing the number of women who are participating as grand round speakers, which you know is pretty rare in academic medicine. Dr. Adam Brown is next to him. He is also an emergency medicine physician. He trained at Thomas Jefferson University, and then he went on to be senior vice president for the Mid-Atlantic for Envision Physician Services and system chief of emergency medicine at Centara, North Virginia. So Dr. Brown, I know, has really taken an active role in grooming and recruiting women to leadership roles. He advocated very strongly for maternity leave policies in his organization, and also has been pretty vocal about making sure that women have flexible schedules, adequate lactation facilities when they return from maternity leave, and he's spurred conversations on gender bias and diversity in emergency medicine. So the three of us are going to spend the next 40 minutes or so sharing our stories about how we became activist champions of change. I'll go first, and then I'll pose a series of questions to my co-panelists. And then we'll come back together, I'll do a closer, and then we'll do a brief activity where we engage all of you in declaring what issues you are ready to be the champion of change for. Sound okay? All right, so to get started, I'm gonna share two stories with you. The first has to do with what you are all doing here today. So in 2010, I was at the Society for Academic Emergency Medicine's annual meeting, and I was on my way to go work out. And I ran into Gail D'Onofrio, who's the chair at Yale Emergency Medicine. I hear a whoop, yeah, okay. And also a really innovative addictions researcher, and she's a longtime mentor of mine. And she grabbed me and said, you need to come with me to the first meeting of AWAM, which is the Academy of Women in Academic Emergency Medicine. And you know, I'd been really looking forward to my workout. But I decided to take the advice of a mentor I knew had my best interests in mind. And so I went with her to that meeting, the only person in spandex. And at that meeting, Kathy Clem, who was the first president of AWAM, passed around sheets so that people could sign up for various committees. And I decided to put my name down for the awards committee. And it turned out I was the only one who did. So I became the chair and all the members of the first AWAM Awards Committee. Now, I knew nothing about awards. That was the best part. I had never won an award. So I just looked up emergency medicine awards to see what was out there, and this is what I learned. So these, at the time, these are all the awards that had ever been given by ASEP. And so every column represents a different awards category. And the purple, as you see, is the number of women who had won those awards. So these awards chiefly went to men. So it was very gratifying to develop a number of awards for women in emergency medicine. And over the next 7 years, we were able to recognize 24 outstanding women across the country for their accomplishments in research, education, advocacy, and leadership. Now, early on, one of the nominees for one of the awards was this hotshot young faculty member from Staten Island Hospital named Dara Cass. You may have met her. Now, Dara, because of this nomination, became very involved in AWAM, and she went on and became hugely engaged in advocating for women in medicine. Dara, of course, came up with the inspired idea for FemineM and developed this conference. And now you are all here today. So I like to think that small act of mentoring, Gail D'Onofrio dragging me to AOM, had a part in bringing you here. And so my first point is, these small acts that you do to boost other women can be the thing that starts momentum that years later becomes amplified beyond what you could have imagined. Make sense? All right. So my second story is about how I became involved in championing for change and getting physicians to protest the Senate healthcare bills this summer. And that moment started when the House passed the American Healthcare Act, the HCA, otherwise known as TrumpCare 1.0. Now, up until this moment, I'd been kind of following along with the healthcare debate, but I didn't own it. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't feel personally responsible. I was like the third-year medical student following along the course of a sick patient, but I wasn't the attending physician. And there were a number of reasons that I wasn't the attending physician. I felt like I didn't think of myself as enough of an expert. I didn't think of myself as an activist. I thought maybe there'd be a better person who'd come along and do it for us. You know, someone who was more qualified and who was more articulate, maybe somebody with fewer children and more time, maybe somebody who had the courage to stand up there in the public eye and face all the criticism and the trolls that were bound to come along with that type of activism. So I'd been kind of hanging back, and then this happened. And I will say, when I read this headline, I felt physically ill, because I knew that this bill was going to affect millions of people, including the most disadvantaged, including women, including children. And those were the groups that I have always been committed to protecting. So I decided in that moment, whether it was true or not, that the outcome of this bill depended on me. And I became completely devoted to fighting this bill. So a couple things sort of worked in my favor that week. The day before this headline came out, I had been working furiously on a grant proposal that had to go in. And for various reasons, the team and I decided that we would delay it until the next NIH cycle. So my plate kind of opened up. And then my husband had been following along this debate with me, and I told him what I had in mind, and he said, I've got you at home. I think I have the bandwidth. I'll just cover for you at home. So I had a little bit of freedom. So I brought together a kind of a crack team, including people in this audience, and we started a project called Doctors Speak Out. It was a hashtag that we used along with the things that we did. And we used social media to gather hundreds of stories of how this bill would negatively impact our patients. I wrote a piece for the popular media talking about the negative aspects of the bill. And we created a doctor's protest video with a bunch of doctors around the country talking about why they had concerns about Trump care. This video was viewed more than 50,000 times, and it earned a mention in the New York Times. And we did this all over a two-week period. And as you know, none of the Trump care bills passed. I will never know for sure if any of the doctors' Doctors Speak Out protest made a difference at all. But I do know that I did everything that I could within the sphere of influence I had. And it seemed to me that at age 44, all these random things I'd been doing, kind of the writing on the side and getting involved in social media and studying health disparities, kind of all converged together with my deepest convictions and allowed me to be as effective as I could where there was a time of need. And so when I thought about this session, I realized I had a hope for all of you. And that is, I hope that all of you recognize when your beliefs and experiences mean that there is no better person to step forward and do it, that actually that there's a time when you're just being cued to step up and be the agent of change. There's going to be time, and I hope you all recognize it, where you have to be the attending physician for your own cause. There's a second part to the doctors speak out story that I'll tell you at the end of the session, but I want to turn now to my other panelists. They have both been really committed to the cause of gender equity and have made diversity just clearly a high priority in your leadership roles. So Dr. Gisondi and Dr. Brown, I want to thank you for joining me on the panel today. I'm going to join you physically now. I think it's super brave how you have committed to improve the working world for women in emergency medicine. I think it's super brave for you to be at this conference where you are clearly in the minority. Welcome to our world. And hopefully in future years, others will take the cue and join you up here on their stage talking about their own work to advocate for women in emergency medicine. So let's start with a couple of questions. And the first one is going to be for both of you. I want you to tell us about your work to change our specialty, to increase the diversity of our specialty, and I want you to describe the accomplishments in this area of which you are most proud. And Dr. Gisondi, we'll start with you.
Well, first, thank you so much for having me on the panel. Thanks to Dr. Cass and Dr. Chu. I feel so not worthy, right? So Dr. Chu, CNN reporter extraordinaire. And they asked me to be on this panel. I don't know how you felt about this, but I was like, you want me to be in a director's chair on stage within the first 2 hours of a gender I have total imposter syndrome. So thank you all for allowing me to even be here, and thank you for the invitation. So to answer your question, I have to give you just a tiny bit of background about me. So I am a medical educator my entire career. I'm 15 years into practice now. And I've held a number of administrative roles, probably some that I held when I was far too young to have them. But I was an associate program director at Northwestern for 7 years following a faculty development fellowship. I was a program director for 7 years. Now I'm a vice chair. I also ran an academy of medical educators at Northwestern. So I've had a lot of leadership roles, and I've had a lot of time to make mistakes. And I think if I could say that I've learned anything or that I have an achievement, it is the learning and then the application of that. So. Of all of the opportunities to mentor folks, and I hope that I've made an impression on folks over the years, my favorite example is the class of 2011 from my residency. And I think there's one member here. Is Dr. Taichi here? There she is. Yay! It's very bright. I didn't know where you were. Okay. So she's going to be able to validate everything I say. So I was always programmed to have a balance of men and women on my rank list. We wanted to have classes that mirrored the patient population that we care for. But we can't do that in emergency medicine, right? We're 75% male, we're 75% white. We do not look like the patients that we treat. So this was my goal, right? I was an APD at the time. We matched this wonderful class in 2008 of 10 women, 2 men, right?
Amazing.
So we did it. And then you know what happened? Within minutes of getting, you know how you get the match list the day before? Within minutes of getting the list, I walk out, I'm like, oh my God, we matched 10 women. This is so amazing. Like, goal achieved. I've done it. I've cracked the code. The match gods gave them to me. And systematically, every single male faculty member walked up to me within an hour and said, you have a huge problem on your hands. What are you thinking? This is going to be terrible. And for 4 years, these poor women went through hell. And if I can say anything, I grew with them, I learned stuff from them, I'm so proud of them, I sent them to academic institutions across the country, and I made a lot of mistakes along the way with that class, but I love them, and that's perhaps, you know, my greatest achievement, my answer to your question.
Okay, and I would love to loop back into those specific challenges, and that will come up later.
Great.
But why don't we move on to Dr. Brown?
Yeah, so just a little bit about me. And we'll get into this a little later. I'm from North Carolina, trained at Jefferson, so back and finished in 2007. My perspective's a little different because I come from the corporate side of medicine and work with contract management groups. And in my role right now, I'm a senior vice president for the Mid-Atlantic region, and that region goes from New York down to North Carolina. The point being is that that's a great opportunity for me to really shape, mold, get people involved, and really grow the practices that we have and get more women into practices in leadership positions. What I learned very early on, and Erica, who's up here in the front, can vouch for some of this. We talked about this very frequently after residency, is the lack of women that we had in leadership within the MCARE, or now Envision, world. And what I think was very important for me as I started to grow in my leadership was not just mentor, but actually look for opportunities to sponsor women into leadership positions. And I think that's an important distinction between the two, between just mentorship and sponsorship. Mentorship is kind of like diversity, where you invite someone to the dance, whereas sponsorship is inclusion, like having someone dance with you at the dance. And so for me, I felt like whenever opportunities came up and I started hearing my colleagues say, hey, we've got a medical director opportunity, what do you think of John? Well, what do you think of Jane? You know, what do you think of this person or that person, and really opening up the idea of having a more inclusive, from a gender perspective, type of leadership. So when I became system chief of emergency medicine in Northern Virginia with a health system called Sentara, I had a couple of opportunities to hire women or hire anyone into leadership positions. And immediately I thought, you know what, this is a great opportunity to reach out to colleagues, friends that I knew were phenomenal educators, were phenomenal leaders, and bring them into the fold as medical directors. So Deborah Lee, I think I spoke with someone earlier, is one of my medical directors. Alice Tang is another one of my medical directors. I hired a lead APP, that's our lingo for PA, nurse practitioner, into a regional role, and another person into a leadership role. All of them are women. My regional practice manager I hired as a woman. Now, I'm a gay guy. I work pretty well with women, and I think that, and I don't mind saying it, you know, hey, I'm an ex-wife feminist, you know, is what I like to say. But the fact is that group has been so phenomenal for me. And to learn from them, to think about different types of things that I never would have thought about, just because I don't have kids, I don't live with a woman, I don't know all of those issues. And so I'll be the first to tell you, I'm ignorant and I need to learn. But what I can say is that reaching out and not giving opportunity, but identifying that there are strong leaders within your midst that you can bring on board has been one of the things that I'm proud of. So now, we have 66% of my team at Northern Virginia are women. 66% of my team are diverse non-white males. That's not just because they're women, but so those are the things that I can say that I'm proud of, and we'll talk about later some of the other initiatives that I've looked at and started and with the help of my colleagues.
And I'm curious, have you found pushback the way that Dr. Ghezzandi did?
Hell yes. But from women, sometimes. In the business world, it's a little different because we don't necessarily have, and I shouldn't say business world because academics is business, but in the non-academic world, we don't see as much disparity with salaries from an hourly rate perspective. I'm sure it exists with stipends for leadership positions. But what I found was not so much challenges in hiring women into leadership positions. I found challenges to implement things like breast pumping rooms that are not on the third or fourth floor, 15 minutes down the hallway, around the corner in a broom closet, where I had the nursing director say, well, you know what, I used to pump driving up and down I-95 on the way to work. First off, don't want that image. Second off, I'm not going to deal with that psychopathy right now. Let's find something that's closer. So I actually said that in the center of our core of our emergency department. So I also had some of the women that I had hired into leadership positions also challenged me even on some of the practices like flexible scheduling, postpartum, or women that were going through fertility treatments. Though there was a challenge, well, how are we going to do this? We're going to figure it out. That's why we wear the leadership hat. That's what we do. So to answer your question, it's a little different from what you experienced, but it was always kind of surprising to me.
Yeah. Great. So the next question is for Dr. Ghezzandi. Mm-hmm. So we are curious, why are you a champion of a cause that does not obviously affect you personally? And what made you open to the problem of gender bias? And I will say my experience has been that most male leaders have not really swallowed the red pill around gender bias. And I'm curious as to why and how you did.
Yeah, I'm gay too. So can I get he got right a round here. Of applause for that, by the way.
Don't leave me hanging.
And I was like,
it's all out now.
Am I not going to get to do that too? All right.
Did you get the toaster oven?
I did.
Okay, yeah. Just checking.
The special one, actually.
Yeah.
I know next year at like Fix 2, you actually have to have a straight guy up here. Like that's going to be, that's when you know you've arrived. Okay. I'll say this. I actually think that though funny, I think that has some part of it, right? I had numerous strong women throughout my life. I'm an only child. My mother was an ER nurse. She was the first person in my family to get a college degree. She got her BSN when I was like 9. I went to her graduation at SUNY Albany. I thought she'd graduated from Harvard. I was so proud of her, right? I went to this crazy Catholic grade school where they ranked us, and I was the salutatorian to a valedictorian, Dana Francesconi, my arch nemesis, who was so smart. She followed me to high school. She beat me there, too. And, you know, I was culturalized to believe that there was no difference. Right? And even going into college, my pre-med advisor, who I'm going to have dinner with when we're all at ASAP, I went to college in D.C., I'm still quite close to a female. My medical school advisor eventually became my boss. Jamie Collins was my advisor at Loyola. She got me to go to a place where there were very few program directors who were women. I went to a place where there was a female program director. And I think perhaps being gay, I was always a little bit more open to being mentored by women, perhaps. I don't know. I think that's probably real.
Like Linda Carter in Wonder Woman.
Oh, my God. All right. That's for a whole nother panel. All right. So, but then I went to residency, and here's where it changed. So all of the stats of, 50% this and that Dr. Birnbauer shared with us, those were my experiences. I didn't experience the 70s, 80s. I always experienced 50-50. Until I got to residency where I matched with Dr. Nolan, now Dr. Keel, who's sitting in the audience, the only woman out of 8 of us. Also the smartest one in our class, by the way. They even gave her the smartest one award. So, like, that's for realsies. She won the award. I didn't win that award. No hard feelings or anything. So she's my Dana Francesconi. So anyway, I saw all these women who were great leaders, and they get to residency, and why at a place with a female program director is there only one woman, and I don't get it. And I think being in medical education, ever since that moment of internship on, now it has to just be equal. But then when it's equal, then what do you do with it, right? So my class of 2011, I matched 10 women. How do I mentor them? Not a single person in our residency leadership at the time had a child. So if they're going to have children, who is going to help them with that? Who's going to navigate that process with them? You hand an anti-discrimination policy to the men is what you do. And then you hope for the best. And that's really sad, right? You go for 50-50, but then what do you do?
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the action plan that I hope people go away from this conference with. We have a moral and ethical obligation as leaders to give opportunity to whomever. I think as emergency physicians, we should look like our patients. But once you get those people in the training programs, can you train them in the right way? Do you make a safe and healthy learning environment?
Great. All right, Dr. Brown, I have one for you. Not dissimilar. So you grew up in Eastern North Carolina.
Barbecue belt.
With very rigid male-female roles and expectations. So how did that change happen for you?
You know, that's interesting because, I mean, I feel like I need a couch and need to be staring up at the ceiling for this question. But the fact is that the roles were extraordinarily rigid. And they came from men from a misogynistic standpoint, but they also came from women, too. And then it was buttressed by religion, because I grew up Southern Baptist, and was at a time an independent Baptist, which is like Jerry Falwell plus. And then in addition to that, it was also supported in the school system, it was supported in the culture everywhere you went. And there's a couple things that stuck out to me that created this cognitive dissonance. Number one, I remember being on vacation with my mom and dad and my brother when we were in Seattle. And the person driving the bus, we were on like a old people's tour, I don't know why, but we were. But the person driving the bus, sorry, that was ageist. But I was 12, so, but I remember.
You checked yourself. That's all that matters.
I did. Yeah. I'm going to say things that may be offensive, and
won't.
I apologize.
You're totally woke.
However, the person driving the bus was female, and I remember my mom saying, you know, she really shouldn't be driving that bus. Why, Mom? Because, you know, women don't drive buses. Women need to be at home. But here's the dissonance. My mom ran her own business. She worked in real estate, and she sold frickin' auto parts. Talk about not the norm, and went to garages to sell auto parts. So you can see there that there was a, it didn't affect me, or it doesn't matter to me because I'm doing my own thing, but the other women out there, they're driving the bus, they shouldn't be, they should be at home. So that was one thing that stuck out that didn't make sense. The other thing that stuck out for me was I remember in third grade being in at Vacation Bible School for Baptists. You'll know that that's like where you get good cookies and lemonade. But I remember one of the Sunday school teachers saying to me, I said, how do we know that Baptists are right?
Oh.
That's like you, you know what I mean? So that's like you asking, you know, being fresh, I think you think what you said. Because you have faith. So all through my life, I had this social construct of what gender norms meant. I had this construct of religion. I had this construct of what women should do, what men should do. And then all of a sudden, a few things kind of came together. Just like in Diane's talk, things kind of come together, and then there's a big change. So my first year in medical school is when I came out of the proverbial closet. To many, the closet door was glass. To my family, the closet door was, I don't know, they had their head in the sand. But I remember a couple things that came together. One, I don't know if Brenna Farmer is here, but she, I know she's speaking at some point this week. But she challenged, I've never told her this, but she challenged me because I was always the top of the class, the male in the top of the class. And now I have a female that is kicking my ass in school. So there was something that was a difference. The other thing that was different is that around my anatomy table is Jerry Bowman, African-American man, Mara Boone, who's from Western North Carolina, who is as liberal comes. She makes Bernie Sanders look conservative. And then there's Deidre, who's Native American. We had the Rainbow Coalition, and me, I was a Republican conservative, white kid, Southern Baptist. And then something happened. I came out of the closet. That house of cards just fell of all of the constructs that I had. So over time, I realized that thing called faith, and this is not to be disparaging, but for me, when someone said, oh, just have faith, that would be saying to us that leeches work. Just have faith. And not to scientifically prove or disprove that. And so that's how the roles changed for me, not only from a diversity perspective, that those people were all better than me standing around the anatomy table, that they tutored me, but it also was the fact that my medical school class, and I want to say it was almost 50-50 women, men. And that really started the change for me to say, wait a minute, a lot of stuff that I was told was not right.
Okay. So I have a series of questions now for both of you. And we'll start back with Dr. Jazandi. So if you had to pick one, what is the greatest challenge we face as champions of change in emergency medicine?
I think the answer is pay equity. Pay equity is the greatest challenge. So pay equity unfolds into a number of different topics. Pay equity is not men and women make the same amount. Pay equity is men and women make the same amount if they do the same job. So it should be pay equity for the same job. And I think if you do a gender audit of salaries in your department, a number of wonderful things will happen. There will be psychological safety for your employees. There will be less suspicion. There will be less backstabbing. There will be less gossip. There will be less angst and worry. And you know what happens then? Then you do good work. Then you take better care of patients. You advance science. You get the grants that you want to get because you have the time to spend writing instead of worrying. And this goes for male-on-male violence, girl-on-girl violence, all of it, right? Because we all have suspicion. So if you just take that away, pay equity is the way to do it. It's the greatest challenge. If you can achieve that, you will unfold so many wonderful things in your department.
Dr. Brown.
So as I was mentioning before, for us, pay equity is a little different just because this is the hourly rate. This is the rate you make. If you work it, you know, you make it. So however, I think it's the greatest challenge, I believe, is more so of ensuring that our providers, whether they're male or female, feel that they are not only feel, but really are making the impact that they want to make. And a part of doing that is ensuring that we are meeting each individual where their needs are. So for example, if I have a woman working for me who just had twins, which I do, what am I doing to support her in her job and support her so that she feels and knows that I'm supporting not only her job but her family, and that she does not feel guilty or bad or what have you to go home, to be there at the PTA night, not for infants, but very aggressive schools in D.C., so that she doesn't feel that way. I think that's a challenge because it changes the conversation that we have to have on the business front. What it may mean is that my FTE, my full-time equivalent of 130 hours, may mean for the new mom or the new dad that they need to have a change where it doesn't create a loss of benefits, or that there is a time frame that they can reset. So I think it's more of a recognition that the way that we keep physicians engaged, which is, I think, a big challenge for men and women across the specialty of emergency medicine. And when I mean engaged, I don't mean you as providers giving to me and doing things for me. What I mean is you feeling like you love what you're doing, you're enjoying the patients you're seeing, you feel that you're getting an impact. But you can't do that if you feel constantly pulled in 1,000 different directions. And so I had a conversation with one of my medical directors just on Monday, and I said to her, I need you not to work 4 to 2, and I need you not to work overnights. And she looked at me and she's like, yeah, but I want to work overnights. I said, okay, let's think about this. You also want to be at home to wake up for your kids to take them to school, and you also want to make sure that you're home in the evening for your kids. And what I'm telling you is I'm giving you permission as your leader and as your friend to decide what is going to work best for you, so that when you're at work, you're not thinking, damn it, I'm missing that conference or that opening school night, or my daughter Leah has a fake stomach ache that I've got to call about or check on. So that's why I think that's the challenge. We've got to start having the dialogue with our providers to find out where do they need to be met? And I think that's how we get away from feeling like we're a cog in the wheel. And at the end of the day, now I have a provider who is more resilient, who feels more connected, who knows I'm more connected with them, who knows I care about them. So from a business perspective, it's a pretty damn good business model, because now I have an employee who wants to stay engaged and wants to work with us. So I think that's the biggest change or challenge, is making sure that we are connected with our team and meeting them where they need, while at the same time doing the great job that we can do.
Awesome. So I think there's a lot of people in this room who feel inspired about bringing change to our specialty. So for those who wish to advance the specialty for women, what advice would you give as people who have kind of been there? I mean, you talked about there's some challenges and some barriers. What's the piece of advice if you're just starting out in this work?
Yeah, I think we have to keep the numbers looking as they were on the slides that Dr. Birnbauer showed. So I think you have to continue to build a pipeline of women in science, women in medicine, women in emergency medicine, and then women in academic emergency medicine who can then train the other women who are in emergency medicine. I think that is critically important. But we have to also do faculty development, right? So my fellowship was in faculty development. I love career transitions. I love when students become residents, and residents become attendings. And then attendings 15 years in don't know what they're going to do, and they have a life crisis, and they change jobs, and the pivots, and all of that. I love it. I study it. I write about it. I enjoy it the most of all of the work that I do. But that faculty development piece, to allow those transitions to happen in the most healthy possible way, to make them be efficient and as effective as all of the other promotions that one might get in life, that comes with a body of knowledge, some foundational knowledge about how to mentor folks. And I don't have all those answers. That's part of my imposter syndrome for sitting here. I think we have to develop those answers. I 100% agree with you on return to work policies being very, very important, right? And you know, Dr. Ewan Wang's here, one of the two female full professors in our department. She wrote a new parent initiative for men and women at Stanford. I highly encourage you to go talk to her about that. We're replicating that for our residents. We're gonna have a wonderful return to work policy for men and women. If you adopt, if you have natural childbirth, all of that included, that's an incredibly hard thing to do, and to thread the needle on what people really want, right? It's very easy to say, I give you permission to not work nights. Well, what if you really want to work nights? That throws the whole policy in chaos. What do you do? These are the challenges, right? We have to fill a pipeline, and then we have to be mature and responsible mentors, advisors, colleagues, and administrators in making sure that the dream we promised is realized. Let's say that.
Yeah, I would say start early with sponsorship, because it starts on a path early. It starts with your daughters. It starts with even your sons, letting them know that, or your nephews, or I'm a gunkle. I'm like a gay uncle, but a funkle, you know. But letting them know they can do what they want. They can be the guys, they can be a ballerina, they can be a pianist, they can be an organist, they can do all of those different things. But they can also do all of the more traditional male things. But they can also, their friends in school, their girlfriends in school, can do traditional male things, like be the doctor, like be the scientist. So I think it starts there with kids, but it also, carrying it more to the employment level, I don't know how many of you guys work with scribes. Anybody here? Yeah. That's a phenomenal breeding ground for starting to scoop someone up and starting to engender a environment that is inclusive and one where they can do it, where you're writing their letters of recommendation, you're putting them in front of committees. I love my scribes, not only because they just are awesome, but because I love my scribes for that reason as well. And then once you get within in your, some of you are not administrators. So how do you advance a specialty? Talk to your administrator about, talk to your leader, talk with other, your mentors about what you need to meet you well where you are to make your life and your job and your environment better. So I think that's a multi-tiered approach, but it's one where we've got to start having this dialogue more open instead of one that is very prescriptive.
Great. So just to close up my questions, since both of you are now in senior leadership positions, how can our FIX 17 attendees go back to their places and support their own bosses in the process of equity? Especially since, you know, I think we can safely make the assumption that most of them do not yet appreciate the gender biases that are affecting women. Where to start?
Yeah, so there's a lot of work to be done, right? So there's a lot of heavy lifting in writing, you know, the policies I alluded to doing the financial analysis of what the impact is, right? So it's a new budget
to be able to endorse a new parent initiative. It's a completely new paradigm for how to fund your faculty, what the FTE really means, what the cost of doing business is, right? You can't just assume that you're going to go back and change a policy overnight and it's going to be great. It takes years, honestly, years of work in a strategic plan to make it happen. And the question that I would then have, and maybe perhaps challenge everyone, you know, are you versed in change management? Change management, you can have a master's degree in change management, right? Change management has a process behind it. It's boring, but it requires someone sitting down. So here's an example. I sat with my chief resident who's writing this return to work policy, new parent initiative for our residents. She's lovely. She has a daughter herself who she had in medical school. She has a great perspective. And she's sitting down. She's like, okay, we have this many pregnant residents, male or female, currently in the system. If we enact this policy today, are we able to cover the shifts in May? And she's sitting down and doing that analysis. We, by the way, have a lot of residents who are pregnant right now. You don't know that. I'm sharing with everyone. We do. Coming down the road, coming in Stanford soon. And can we make this work? And it takes the sitting in a cafeteria, which is what we did for over an hour, sitting there doing math and coming back and saying, all right, well, now how do we change the policy? What if we had one more? What if one more? Can we still? That's the kind of work that I would say you have to go back and support your administrators by doing that work. The heavy lifting doesn't happen overnight. It's a strategic plan that you have to endorse, you know, fiscal year after fiscal year.
So supporting the bosses, you know, it's tough because some of you may not be in environments where you feel that your boss would be want to listen to what you have to say. And I don't have a great answer for you, unfortunately. I wish I did. That may not be the place where you want to see yourself for a long time. What I can say is really opening up a dialogue with your boss, and I kind of hate the word boss, sorry, but your leader or your supervisor, you know, who is working with you to come up what you need. You know, I said this before, meet you where you need to be. One of the things I did was I did a journal club a few months ago, yes, at a non-academic facility. I did a journal club. And there was alcohol involved. But I did a journal club. And one of the journal articles, Dara actually pointed me in that direction, was the mustache quotient article. I'm sure a lot of you have heard about that. You know, while women have been increasing in numbers in medical school, they still are very, the numbers are quite low for leadership positions in academic medicine. And what that article and what that discussion allowed a lot of us to do was start sharing about the challenges that each of our team, whether they are gay, straight, from whatever ethnic background or gender they were, to discuss what are some things that I can help them support. So I think from the leader standpoint, having the open door policy is important. On the reverse, I've got to have information coming to me. To your point, Mike, about the operational aspect of things, to make some of these policies work, there are many of you out there that are much stronger at operations than some of your bosses or leaders. And you may be the person who is required to show them that the policy that you want to implement can work. And so I encourage you to think operationally, too, when a lot of these policies are being rolled out, to how can you financially make it smarter? Like, it costs over $50,000 to $60,000 to hire a new doc. That should tell you something. If you're in a non-academic facility, I don't know what it is in the academic world, but similarly, from an operational standpoint, I would much rather hire someone on part-time to help support a mom or a dad who wants to be at home during the infant's time period in a part-time fashion than lose that doc because they've gotten so pissed off. And now I've got to hire someone and find and train someone. So that I think is something important. So we need information coming back. We need you folks who may see that you have the opportunity, when you kind of come forth with a policy, with that policy, I like to tell this to my medical directors, present something to me, put it in a PowerPoint, put it in a presentation. Since business school, it's PowerPoint and spreadsheets, and so that's how I talk now. But that's how the information I like as a leader coming back.
Okay. I just want to thank you both for being so engaged and thoughtful around the process of equity.
All right, so just to close out, I promised I would tell you the second part of the doctor's speak out story. So this is what happened next. A friend of mine named Nusheen Aminuddin, who's a pediatrician in Minnesota, liked the doctor's speak out protest, and she decided to do the same thing, focusing on issues related to kids for the American Academy of Pediatrics. So she started a hashtag project called Keep Kids Covered. And right off the bat, Keep Kids Covered was much more successful than Doctors Speak Out. It had a huge following. There were many more physicians involved. There were many more videos. It got a ton of attention from the media, from the public, and from policymakers. And so when I thought back, I realized that the best thing I did with Doctors Speak Out was actually empower somebody else to do an even better job. And that's what I like about Dr. Brown and Dr. Jazandi's work as well. All of the physicians that you influence will go on and they will in turn influence other lives and other future physicians. And so I really want you to think about the change that you champion as amplifying in two different ways. First, no matter where you are, as you go back after this conference and you institute these little changes, whether it's to your personal life or your work or your communities, think of those as all as dress rehearsals for the changes of increasing size and influence that you will affect as you progress through your careers. The second thing is that every time you champion a change, you are catalyzing the careers of the next generation of women physicians, and they will go on and do amazing things in their careers in the new world that we helped create. So I want you guys to do something now. So on your badges, are you guys all wearing your badges? So if you look at your badges, there's a little funny little sticker in the corner, right?
Oh.
Aha, you were wondering. And it says either a champion of change for, a change agent for, or catalyst for. And so there should be Sharpies floating around. We didn't get 250, but we were passing out maybe 50 or so. There, you think regular pens will work? You can try it, but either grab a Sharpie. Those you can write quickly and then pass them down your row, or you can try your pen or just use your brain. So I guess just pick quickly. The issue that you're going to own, that you're going to be the attending physician for, okay? So it can be any change, small or large, as long as you feel deeply committed to it. So I'll give you guys a minute to write. I know it feels like a huge commitment. It's just a Sharpie marker on a sticker. We're not going to be like, a year ago, you said on your sticker, and we expect to see you on, you know, national news. Is anybody willing to shout out, though, what they are committed to changing?
Yeah, I think men should get pregnant.
Men should get pregnant. So the science will start here. Implanted uteri and pregnancies for men. I like it. Anything else?
Gun control.
Champion change for gun control.
Single-payer healthcare.
What?
Anti-bullying.
Single-payer healthcare. Single-payer healthcare for all. Elect a woman president. Doable.
I had a dream about that.
Empowering confidence.
Wellness.
Physician wellness.
Refugee health.
Reproductive rights.
Reproductive rights.
Ending white supremacy in healthcare. You guys didn't really go on the small end of the spectrum. Where's the world peace person? Come on, somebody out yourself. World peace right there. Okay. So I really look forward for wait, there's one more. Another envisioned physician.
Yay.
We need a maternity leave policy. That sounds...
Let's work together on
this. This is going to happen here. So I really look forward. I think the three of us really look forward to meeting many of you and hearing about the issues that you're going to champion in years to come. I know that you have the potential to catalyze a ton of change that will deeply influence the practice of medicine. And I think some of those change agents that we heard from, I think you'll go forward and do things that will become the big stories that we'll hear about on this stage in years to come. Thank you very much.